Some time ago, when my children were much littler than they are now, I think Rosemary was 3 and Faye was 6, I was still in seminary, and I had become quite a couch potato because I spent all of my time sitting in classes, sitting in the library, or sitting in front of my computer. And I was completely out of shape. And I was low on money, and so I thought I would kill 2 birds with 1 stone by starting to bike my children to school instead of driving them. Pretty smart, you think? Yeah. I don't see many heads nodding. Okay, so anyway, I decided this is what I do. So my mother had a bicycle she wasn't using, and my brother and his family had one of those trailers you can attach to the bike, you know, where the little children can sit in there, and there's a little room for their backpacks or whatever, and their lunch boxes. It has like a zipper, you know, netting thing over them, so I don't know, flies don't get in. And I figured out how to hook this whole thing up. It's like a tent, right? You know, you can see. So I hooked this whole thing up, and I got ready to go, and it was a big day. I was going to bike them to the place. It was about 3/4 of a mile away, and my mother was so excited, she even came out and got pictures of me on the bicycle with the children in the trailer and my helmet on, ready to go. I was going to get in shape, save gas money, do something good for the environment. It was all good. It made perfect sense. I had the perfect solution to all these problems. So, in today's story, are we familiar with this story, the beheading of John the Baptist? This story is filled, and the way we hear it is filled with misunderstandings. Who knows the name of Herod's daughter? What was her name? Go ahead, Jeff. Salome. Yeah, Salome. Have you heard of Salome before? How many people have heard that? Yeah. Did you notice it wasn't actually in the book? Yeah, that was made up after the fact. People assigned a name to her. Do we know how old she was? 18, 19? Yeah. Some people think that she's like 16, 17. If you look at artwork depicting her, she's generally depicted as this very sort of voluptuous, scantily clad dancer. And that's why Herod was so pleased. It says nothing about that. It just says she was a young girl. So I'm going to ask you to suspend what you think you know about this story, because there's lots in here that says that it's true, but it isn't actually true. For example, they talk about King Herod, and he talks about his kingdom. He wasn't a king. He did not have a kingdom. He was a tetrarch. He was someone appointed by the Roman government over areas of Jerusalem and Israel to govern on their behalf. He was not elected by the people. He did not serve the people. He served the Roman government. And he did not own that land. The Roman government owned that land. He was in charge of it. He probably owned the clothes on his back and some of his money in his bank account. But the lands, the properties, absolutely not. He didn't own them. So he's a bit of a fibber when he says, anything you want, up to half my kingdom, name it, and it will be yours. He didn't actually have anything. That's like me promising half this church and all its property to anyone that just is so pleasing to me. I don't own it. It's not mine. So John the Baptist, we heard a little bit about him today with the children's moment. We hear more about him in this book because he doesn't actually say that much in the Bible. We hear him when he first baptizes Jesus and he's talking about helping the poor and overturning the corruption of the day. And then we hear a little bit about him here, where we have Herodias and Herod, both from the Herod family. And John has a problem with Herodias and with Herod, partly because they're not a good family. They are social climbers. They are serving the Roman government, not the people that they're supposed to be serving, and because they're doing things that are illegal. Do you remember when Jesus was born, it was a King Herod that ordered that all of the infant boys should be killed? And this is the kind of family, right? Now, this is the next generation. So Herodias was married to someone else, and Herod took a liking to her. And it was socially advantageous for them to combine powers and wealth. So he just married her, which was contrary to Levitical law. He wasn't allowed to do that. And John the Baptist was not being quiet about this. He was again and again saying this is a problem, and he was confronting them about it and talking about it in public. And so Herodias, the wife, has a beef with John the Baptist. You see that? Now, it's easy for her to have a beef with him because you have to recognize that she was very isolated. She lived kind of in an ivory tower. She was not aware of how much her actions were affecting other people, and she didn't care because whatever she did sort of sustained the power structure that allowed her to continue claiming socially and do whatever she wanted. And John the Baptist was threatening that. Do you see that? John the Baptist was threatening. He was threatening to poke a hole in that little inflated balloon of hers. So John the Baptist, however, recognized that in order to affect social change, he had to keep talking about it. He had to keep talking to as many people as possible. So that day I'm on my bike. I've got my helmet on. I've got the kids behind me. And I start down that hill, right? A little bit of a hill across the street, and then it was pretty much, seemed like a pretty flat, you know, maybe a tiny, tiny incline, but pretty flat the rest of the way. And things did not go the way that I planned. I mostly remember my children saying really cute little things like, "Mommy, why are you making such funny noises? Mommy, why do you keep stopping? Mommy, why are you bending over again? Mommy, go faster. Why are you walking instead of riding the bike?" And so on. And I was having to stop pretty often to catch my breath, bending over, gasping, heaving, while they're zipped into this little trailer trying to figure out what's going on behind them. It was hard. It was harder than I thought. This simple solution that I thought would take care of everything, it was harder than I thought. And it started to come to my understanding. I was aware that if you want to get out of shape, all you have to do is stop exercising for 3 days. If you want to get into shape, you got to exercise consistently for 6 weeks. Right? Okay, so this was day one, and I was hauling about 100 pounds worth of children and gear up what turned out to be just a little slight incline. It was harder than I thought, and it was going to require some sustained effort. So in the world of the Herods, we see this terrible trinity of isolation, ignorance, and a power structure that is unbalanced. And it was able to maintain the status quo, these three things. And we see this same problem today. When we look at the recent shootings in Charleston with Dylann Roof, media quickly said that he was an isolated example of this problem. He was probably mentally ill, but I don't believe that. I think that he was a product of isolation, ignorance, and a power structure that he believed entitled him to maintain a status quo where he's on top and other people are on the bottom. And it's a very dangerous combination. It perpetuates a status quo, but it's even more deadly when it's weaponized. Do you understand that? It's even more deadly when it's weaponized. It doesn't just perpetuate disenfranchisement for large groups of people. It can become deadly. So we watch what John the Baptist was trying to do when he's talking about the status quo that was happening at that time period with the Roman government and these puppet leaders, and how many of the people were hungry and how many of them were oppressed. And John the Baptist, what he's talking about when he first appears is sharing. If you have food that's a little more than you need, share it. If you have an extra coat and someone does not have a coat, give them that coat. That's balancing the power structure. Do you see that? And we see he talks about repenting, changing what you're doing. That shows an awareness that there's a problem. That's the opposite of ignorance. You see that? He's countering the Trinity, and he's trying to balance those power structures. And when everybody's coming down to the river and he's talking to all of them, that's removing the isolation because everybody can look one another in the eye and have a conversation with one another. That's the opposite of isolation. That's community. So the exact same problem that we have today, John the Baptist was trying to fight, which is what made him so dangerous to the Herods. So we have this dinner party. Herod is having his birthday, and he's probably had a little to drink. I'm guessing if they're having a feast, the wine was probably flowing. This little girl is looking all cute. You know, she's dancing in her little frock or whatever, as children often do. And he's so tickled by this. And he's feeling a little grandiose and flush with wine, and he wants to impress his friends that are around. And so he makes this promise. Name it, whatever you would like. Whatever you would like, just name it, and I will give it to you, up to half my kingdom. Now, he's not the first man or woman to make a grandiose promise after having a little too much to drink when he's trying to show off in front of his friends. The problem was he was in a position of great power when he made this promise. He had the ability to act on it. So this little girl doesn't know what to do. She might have, you imagine her being a little surprised, a little blushing maybe, when he suddenly calls her out like that. So what does she do? She runs to her mother and says, "What should I ask for?" This would have been a great time to say, "Sweetie, he's had a little too much to drink. Don't worry about it. I'll get you a puppy tomorrow," right? This would have been a great time to talk to her about, you know, having integrity or acting wisely or being judicious with your power. But instead, Herodias has an opportunity. She sees a huge opportunity. In effect, she was handed the weapon she had been wanting for a long time. And when she was handed that weapon, all of her isolation, all of her ignorance, and all of her entitlement was suddenly weaponized. So of course, she pointed it towards the one thing that threatened to take away everything she had. She pointed it at the local black church that had spent its life fighting poverty and racism and lifting up the oppressed and challenging corruption and the status quo. Its name just happened to be John the Baptist. So, when I finally, eventually, after many stops, made it to my children's school, I thought I was going to die. The children, I unzipped them. They jumped out with their stuff and scampered into the school. And I limped up the stairs, heaving. And collapsed on the living room carpet because it was a school. She was teaching a Montessori school. They were in a Montessori school for the first few years. I collapsed on my sister-in-law's carpet in the living room, gasping and panting for breath. And she's like, "Are you okay?" And I could just sort of mouth the word water. Water, I'm going to die. It was hard. And it was painful changing what you're doing. It's painful learning new skills, not only mentally, but physically. So John the Baptist, in all of his talking at that river that day, said there's going to be this guy coming after us, and he's got some pretty good ideas. And Jesus did. He took what John had been talking about and made it absolutely concrete. In response to isolation, he brought different people from different walks of lives to break bread together, to look one another in the eye and see each other. And he did this everywhere that he went, in different communities, especially those that were traditionally outcast, the lepers, the tax collectors, the prostitutes. He made the Bible accessible, which is really big, because nowadays, a lot of people don't read the Bible. We don't necessarily think that it's relevant anymore. A lot of America doesn't think it's relevant anymore. But I want you to think back to a time when most people were not literate. And if there was a book in the town, there would have only been one book, and it would have been the Bible. It would have been the Torah scrolls. That would have been it. That was the definitive source at that time for law, science, history, philosophy, poetry, music, health, politics, and religion, all in one book. And at that point, only some people had access to it. Jesus sat down with people and taught it and made it accessible to counter the ignorance that was being used against them when the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the temple leadership would say, "Here's the rules. They all apply to you. But, you know, we can do whatever we want." He educated them so that they understood what their rights and responsibilities were, and that was very empowering. And he also called out corruption and hypocrisy and inequality everywhere that he saw it to counter the power imbalances. And he recognized that this wasn't something that you do once and then it's over. This was an ongoing conversation. This was an ongoing struggle. That's why he says the poor will always be with us. There will never be a time when we can say, well, poverty's dead. We don't have to worry about it anymore. Whew, good for us. And pat ourselves on the back. There will never be that time. There will always be more that we can do. There will always be more problems that we can tackle if we can continue to fight the isolation, ignorance, and entitlement that allows them to perpetuate. So here's the problem. Here's the problem. When we start to make changes, Bowen's family systems theory talks about when there's a system in place and we try to make a change to that system, even if it's in everybody's best interest, there's always going to be a change back reaction. There's always going to be someone that says, no, 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 no. I refuse. And they will lash back. Like anyone that's tried, for example, in drug addicted families, there's an individual that is abusing and the parents start setting up boundaries. Well, you can do what you want, but we're not going to give you money anymore. And we're not going to let you bring, you know, drugs into the house anymore. There will be a huge reaction to that. There'll be a crisis presented that will force them to decide, well, do we want to go along with this or do we want to go back to the old way? Does this make sense? There's always going to be a change back reaction. And they're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until they finally realize the system has changed. You can either come along with the system or you can go someplace else. This is how change works. And that's how it works in families. That's how it works in individuals. And that's how it works in societies. Right? I had that huge reaction. I never wanted to exercise again, let me tell you. It was painful. It was painful. So I've been watching the news and seeing that black churches are being torched across the South. I think there's 9 now in the past few weeks. Now, I wasn't of the generation when that was a thing, but it was a thing back in the 40s and 50s, right around the time when they were fighting about the civil rights movement. It was a thing. It's becoming a thing again. And it's a horrible thing. There is no way that this is a good thing. But the one thing I can say about it is that it is clear that it is a change back reaction. And that's a good thing. Because what that means is society is changing. We're having birthing pains right now. With the advent of the internet, we're able to keep this conversation on the table. We're able to break isolation because people across the country can talk to each other in real time. People can end their ignorance because pictures of what is actually happening in the communities are able to be posted immediately, so people can see real-time footage of what's actually happening. That breaks ignorance and isolation, and it allows people to recognize that there's a sense of entitlement that needs to change, and laws are changing. People are being held accountable in a way that they were not being held accountable before. If this were a family, this would be a time to say, you know, we've decided to take a move towards health. These are the new rules. And the one person that has a real problem is going to start blowing up and creating as much crisis and as much drama and as much chaos as they possibly can to get everybody to say, oh, well, you're right, never mind. You know what? This is too painful. We'll go back to the way things were, where you get to have all the goodies and we all just deal with it. When I see black churches burning, that's a sign that the people that want to maintain the sense of entitlement and isolation are running scared. That's not a bad thing. That means they're recognizing that they get to make choices now. Do they want to join the new healthy system? Or do they want to go someplace else? But things will not be the same as they were. They cannot and they will not. And I see signs of hope. For example, did you hear about the big protest around the mosque in Phoenix where a bunch of armed Americans showed up surrounding this mosque to protest Muslims? It was ugly. It was not a happy chapter in our history. And at the same time, the signs of hope were the people within the mosque came out and invited anyone who wanted to come in and join them for prayer. Only a couple people did it. And one man went in. He had come armed with racial epithets on his T-shirt. And he went in there and he was shocked. he came out a completely changed man. Because what happened when he went in there was he saw peaceful people praying. He sat down face to face with people, had a chance to ask questions and talk with them about what faith is, what faith means, what God looks like. He was able to participate with them in their worship service. And when he left, he said, I'm not going to wear this t-shirt anymore. I think Muslims are good people and they have a right to be here, and I'm so sorry I went to this protest. Because in walking into that mosque, it broke the isolation, because he had to come face to face with the people that he had never actually really met or engaged with. He was able to break his ignorance, because he thought what he thought Muslims were, what he thought Islam was not real. He was actually able to see it face to face, and it changed his perspective. It ended his ignorance. And he realized in doing that that there was a power structure that he had that he didn't want anymore. It didn't fit. And he wanted a new system, and it changed him. I see great signs of hope. Great signs of hope. And when I look at what we're doing in this church, as opportunities have presented themselves and as people have come to me with suggestions for things they want to talk about in regards to race relations, what's ended up happening over the past, it's been 6 or 7 months now, is we've had other people, and we're continuing to have other people come in with different perspectives to our church, to our Bible study, in the form of performances, in the form of photographic presentations, in preaching, come in and give different perspectives. That ends our isolation. That breaks through our understanding of what other people think and what we think. It ends ignorance. And as we are working with things like our summer program, where we're actively taking steps to beat achievement gaps which affect students in Marin County along color lines, we're actively starting to make changes to the system. This is all good news. The only thing is, it's really important to remember that it can be painful. We may get change back reactions. I haven't seen any yet, which is good. But I'm waiting. I'm waiting for someone in the community to say, shame on you, who do you think you are? I'm waiting for that. And we have to remember this conversation isn't going to go away, and it can't go away. We're going to keep talking about it, just like when you decide on New Year's Day to make that resolution to join the gym and everybody's there January 2nd, but the gym is empty by January 15th. We got to keep going. We can't say, well, we're in shape now. We're completely in shape. I can sit on the couch for the rest of my life and not have to worry about it. It doesn't work that way. So that day, I was lying on my sister-in-law's carpet, gasping for breath, in pain. And I remember thinking distinctly, this is too hard. I was trying to get myself in shape, save money on gas, you know, do something good for the environment. But I kept thinking, at what cost? Because if it's going to take me like an hour and a half to get from home to the school every day, is that really, are the gains really worth it? That's what was going through my mind. If it's going to take me an hour and a half and this much pain, the small amount of gas that I save, right, the small amount of money that I save, is it really worth it in the end? And so I decided to try and fumble and get my phone out of my purse to check the time, to just say, you know, how long did it really take me to get from here to here? Because if it's like 2 hours like it felt like, you know, forget it. I'm ashamed to say it was exactly 15 minutes from door to door. 15 minutes, and I had to stop 3 times, doubled over, gasping for breath. And that's a good thing, because it let me know how big the problem was. When I felt the pain myself, I understood how big the problem was and how much effort and sustained effort it would take to be able to undo the problem. So Jesus gives us a path. Jesus gives us a hope. Jesus gives us the power of God to sustain us when we feel like we can go no further, and gives us the awareness that when we see a change back reaction, that's a good thing. We're going in the right direction. Don't stop. Can I get an amen to that?